and welcome to Two Fat Expats. And when we say fat, we're not talking bathroom scales or excess luggage. Two Fat Expats are all about making the most of your expat adventure and filling it up with as much as you can so that when it's all over, there's no regrets. You've lived a fat expat life. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie expat who's based in Doha, Qatar. And I'm joined by Nikki Moffat.
Hello.
Another Aussie, but Nikki's in Hamburg, Germany. We've lived in 12 countries between us. We consider ourselves experts in all matters of the geographically challenged. Between us, we've given birth in 6 countries, and we know what it's like to pack up yet another kitchen, start looking for another job, and wave goodbye to that brilliant hairdresser it took you 12 months to find. We've both made those first steps into the brand new office, or worse, the new school, and at times we've found ourselves jobless, friendless, and starting afresh all over again. Each week we talk to expats who are from all over the world, and we discuss our favourite finds, our biggest stuff-ups, and we get the best tips for packing it all in. Okay, are we ready to go? Let's do this. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
Oh, Kirsty Rice. I'm relieved, exhausted, a little bit of a tiz. It's been a big week.
It has been a big week for you, and I think I may have found the secret to how we get a nice, short, swift podcast, and that is get you back to work and then arrange the recording for 6 a.m. your time so that you have to work on a time frame.
Oh, it's all me. I'm always the one that makes it go long. Yes, we all believe that. But you're right. I did. I started a new job. I actually went to our, just an update for all the podcast listeners who may not have heard any other way. I went to the visa office last Monday morning at before 6 o'clock, because at our visa office, you have to write down your name. And then that's the order that you get your appointment for the day. And they open the doors at 6 a.m. There was a bit of hustle and bustle outside the doors. So it's quite impressive. And then after 4 nail-biting hours, they approved our visas. So the children and I are able to stay in Germany while my husband lives in another country. And then I went straight from there. Someone said, did you go and open a bottle of champagne? I said, no. I went straight to my first day in an office in 10 years.
And how's it going? How's it going? What's it like being back at work after 10 years? Actually, no. I'm not going to say that. It's not back at work because you've done plenty of work. It really is your first time back in the office though, isn't it?
Yes. And it's weird being back in an office. And the last time I was in an office, I worked for a very large multinational company. And now I'm working for a much smaller sort of nimble company. And also I'm working in an industry I've never worked in before, which is bizarre. But it's good because you get to wear all black all the time, which is right up my alley. and yeah, look, it's exhausting. And I think, you know, all the things that you think about, and I'm working so 5 hours a day, but 5 hours a day really is quite a lot of your day.
Yes.
Because when you work 5 hours, you don't take any breaks. So you're not having a lunch break or a morning snack break or whatever it is that people have.
Yeah.
And then you're out, and then you got to do all the other things you were already doing before anyway. So, and then all of a sudden your children are already home, and there's homework and dinner and all the things that you used to sort of be able to work up to a little bit more, or just have more flexibility in your scheduling. So Look, it's great. I'm not complaining at all. I'm quite enjoying it, although I am not worthy, not even hipster enough to work in an architectural firm in a very cool area of Hamburg. It's sort of like this artist enclave area. So every time I walk in, I feel like a total fraud. But apart from that, it's all good.
I hear you. I went back to work. I think it was 9 till 2 the first time I went back to work in the office. And, yeah, I still remember that sprint to run to the car to then get to the school pickup. And it is. It's a nightmare. And everybody else who doesn't have those commitments is all breezing around, having lunch, going for coffees, doing whatever. But you know that you've got 5 hours to get everything done. There's no leisure time, is there?
No. And I used to think, You know, I don't really do much in the mornings, you know, and now there's all these things I can't do anymore. I can't go to this. I can't do this meeting or have this coffee morning, et cetera, because now I'm working. And so I think, oh, actually, I used to be a little bit more active than I thought. But I am walking to work, which I'm really enjoying.
Nice.
And I think it's a great way to start my day. So, and I'm walking home. So I'm getting in my 10,000 steps for sure.
Okay, Nikki, this week we are talking about expat anxiety. And our special guest is Ryan McConnell this week, who is a mental health specialist. He's based here in Doha. What I loved about Ryan when we initially got talking was he mentioned something, because I was saying to him, I guess, you know, I get very, very protective of our group here at Two Fat Expats, and I get very protective about the people we introduce to the group. And so I said to Ryan, you know, kicked off with a nice light, why are you qualified to answer this question, Ryan? And
I may not have 15 years of university, but I on this topic, but I am protective of my group.
And I loved his answer, because, you know, so often in the professional world, people automatically jump to the defensive about why they're an expert, you know, why you should talk to them. But Ryan mentioned something to me that I had to immediately go and look up. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Have you heard about the Dunning-Kruger effect, Nikki?
Well, I haven't. Let's say I haven't, and you can explain it to me.
Well, he talked about the Dunning-Kruger scale, which was two guys who had come up with this scale for, and it was basically, he was saying, when people first learn something, they, I guess they get sucked into this belief that they actually know a lot more about something than they do. And because he was talking about the Dunning-Kruger scale of learning, and he said, you know, I've gone past my first peak and I've gone down into that next peak where you think you know everything you know, and then you suddenly know enough that you realize, well, actually, I don't know that much at all. And I just thought about all the times I've done this in my life, whether it's been anything that I've learned where I've thought, even from babies to podcasting to writing to every skill that you get, there is that, oh, yeah, I've nailed this, bang, next day, oh, actually, I don't know anything about this at all. Anyway, Ryan does know a lot, and he is a great talent to talk to, and I've really enjoyed our conversation. I'm definitely going to get Ryan to come back and talk about many different things when it comes to mental health, because I think there is so much for us to discuss, whether it's anxiety or depression or phobias or separation anxiety or so many things that happen in the expat world, because we do continuously push ourselves out of our comfort zone. But today it's all about anxiety, and I began by asking Ryan, what is anxiety?
So anxiety is just a kind of worried, nervous emotion. It's a very, it's a human emotion. So all human beings will experience anxiety, and it's designed to really protect you. So if you imagine some 100,000, 50,000 years ago, you're a cave woman, caveman, whatever, walking around doing your thing, and you spot a snake, and you don't have no idea what a snake is because you've never seen one before. You go, okay, well, what is this thing? You go forward to pet it, and it bites you. You think, ow, okay, that really hurt. Don't touch those weird danger noodle things because they really, really hurt, and I should avoid these for sure in the future. So anytime you would encounter a snake again, you would have a pang of anxiety because you're facing something which is an obvious danger. And then if you imagine in terms of how we developed, evolutionary speaking, the world was filled with dangers from everything from, you know, mountain lions to disease to weather conditions. Everything seemed like it was kind of out to get us. So anxiety is really a way of the body going into a kind of paranoid defense mechanism. But the issue is that it's not logically or rationally focused. It's just a symptom of being in a paranoid state. So it doesn't have, you know, you can't turn it off as sensibly as you could. You might sit there and you think, well, why do I feel anxious all the time? I feel anxious about nothing. This wasn't worth being anxious about. What's going on? Why do I feel like this? So the best way to think of your anxiety is like a guard dog inside of yourself, but much like a guard dog, it struggles sometimes to differentiate between what is a burglar and what is the mailman, and may just randomly attack either way. In terms of what's going on chemically, this is elevated adrenaline and cortisol levels. So adrenaline is your fight or flight response. So it kind of puts you into a readied state of, okay, I might have to defend myself, what's going on? You'll find when you're anxious, you're much more twitchy and you're looking around for different dangers around you. Cortisol is a general stress hormone. So that's why you have this elevated heartbeat, the elevated blood pressure when you're anxious, because you're in a kind of I'm ready for danger type of state. The issue is, of course, that if you spend all of your time in this sort of state, you're going to feel extremely tired and drained and demotivated, irritable, restless, all those kind of other things that come with being in an anxious state a lot. So what would, say, differentiate between being anxious, being like, you know, rationally anxious to a point where it's just anxiety, you know, slight anxiety that's controllable, and uncontrollable anxiety would really be how much is it governing your life and can you turn it off and on as you need to? So can you relax when you need to? And are you saying to yourself, God, I feel so anxious all the time? If you're really doing one of those things, then the chances are that you probably have a mild form of anxiety disorder. The other thing as well is you should think of anxiety disorders much more on a spectrum or a scale. Like I score 3 out of 10 on my, like, an anxiety disorder, rather than a discrete disorder of you either have it or you don't, if you know what I mean. So most people will be scoring, you know, somewhere between maybe like 3 and 6 on the anxiety scale, and that might be fine. But then, say, anything past that is where you probably want to start really trying to manage your anxiety in your life. So if you're sitting there thinking to yourself, you know, I feel like I'm anxious quite a lot here, chances are that you need to take charge of that and start counteracting it really as soon as possible, in order to just really raise the quality of your life.
Okay. And Ryan, why would an expat be more likely to suffer from anxiety?
So if you're referring to, say, specifically here in Canada, it's a place that is designed for work. Unless you're local, you've come here to work. I mean, that is what, like, 90% of people in the country. It's a staggeringly high percentage of people who've come specifically just to work. So with that in mind, you're not really bring the element of fun or entertainment into your life, designed to have people come and work here. The other factors as well, you're away from your family. Pretty much everyone's away from their family here. Some people have come and their wife and kids are even in a different country. It's just very difficult because there's a form of anxiety called separation anxiety, which is where you're not receiving enough hugs and enough loving affection. So we produce a hormone called oxytocin it's called the love hormone. And we get that when we spend a lot of time hugging and cuddling and kissing and just having that close connection with another human being. So if you're far away from that, then you'll get the way you manage your anxiety and stress will be heightened. It's a environment that's quite cutthroat. You can lose your job really at any time without any real recourse, and that's that.
Yeah. Everything you've said makes sense for all expats, I think. One of the things I hadn't thought of is the separation anxiety, because, I mean, a lot of people might travel with a spouse or with their children, or other people are completely on their own. But, I mean, we can all miss...
Yeah.
Separation can be from everything, can't it? From everything that you understand as real in your world.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're away from, for sure, you're away from your close family, right? You're away from the neighborhood you grew up in. You're away from those kind of people, the streets you know, the places that you're comfortable with, the routine you're more comfortable with. So in that regard, you are definitely more likely to experience anxiety being an expat. There is several reasons why you might be anxious. It's not it's not its individual construct. It's more of a symptom of what's going on. So you could find someone who has basically nothing and they're a really happy individual, and you think, okay, well, why is this person so happy? And you bring that back to, well, they have a more positive mindset. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it means that events in their life have occurred in a more positive way than perhaps they have occurred in yours. So if you've experienced some form of trauma in the past, like if you imagine a child whose parents locked them in a broom cupboard continuously, they're going to be a more anxious individual than someone who hasn't. Why? Because anxiety, as I said, it's this guard dog state within oneself. So if that child who's been repeatedly put on alert is going to carry that same alertness all throughout their life, and one of the things they're really going to have to deal with is being able to turn off this guard dog state, because from a young age that's what was brought into them, right? Something else to bear in mind is anxiety, raised anxiety levels can also be a genetic factor. So if your parents, grandparents, auntie, uncle, brother, sister, and so forth tend to be quite anxious individuals, chances are you can trace it through your lineage of, okay, with this heightened anxiety gene, I can see that in my mother, I can see that in my father, I can see that in my grandparents, right? In that case, you may have a more anxious disposition than someone else, even if you both had relatively fine childhoods and you weren't bullied, for example. So in that case, there's not too much you can do other than continuously be proactive on how you manage your anxiety. This would be raising your GABA, your serotonin, your oxytocin levels. How do you do this? Well, you want to make sure that you have a very good diet, a balanced diet. You should largely try and avoid heavy white carbs that jack your sugar levels up. You're going to want to make sure that you're getting enough oxygen in your system, which is why I always recommend an element of breathing techniques. Actually, one of the things I'll ask you to put in the link for the description is I'll send you this video, and it's from a guy called Wim Hof, who is the Iceman. He's a fantastic human being. He has something like 20 world records at this point, a lot of endurance related records, and he's just a very average guy. But what he does is a type of breathing technique which raises the oxygen levels in your body. Essentially, the way it does this is by having your body mimic being at altitude, which creates more of a hormone called EPO, which allows the body to retain oxygen better. What does that do? Well, like all muscles in the body, your brain is a muscle. So the more oxygen that you put into your body, the more your brain is going to function. You'll find that you're sharper, quicker, but not only that, you feel a natural high, really quality feeling for about 6 hours afterwards. And I'd be looking into this just for a training perspective. However, I found that it actually turned out to be extremely effective at managing anxiety. So one of the very first things I teach people who come and see me at the end of every first session I do is I teach them this breathing technique. Training, also very good. Meditation as well. One of the reasons that we might feel like we're anxious for quite a long period of time in duration is because we're in our own heads a lot, right? We've got these intrusive thoughts and we're chewing it over and over and over again in our head. So what's going on there? Well, you're letting your internal monologue really dictate what's going on in your life, and you're not allowing your brain to rest as it should. So meditation is really the art of turning off your internal monologue. That takes some practice, however. So it's normally one of the last things I teach people, because it's actually much easier to train your body and your diet than it is to make a change in your mindset, which can take several months realistically. In terms of anything else that I would recommend, it can be quite good to accept your anxiety and then try and rational it out. So if you said, for example, I'm really nervous about giving this presentation. Okay, why? Well, I'm worried on what people might think of me. I'm worried that they might judge me. I'm worried I might get fired. I'm worried that I might look like an idiot. Okay, well, has this happened in the past? Well, no, not really. Okay, so we don't have any evidence to suggest that this has happened in the past. Why would that happen right now? So although it's an irrational emotion, you can somewhat rationalize it out in your own head, which can really help make progress.
Yeah, I was just thinking it would be a great exercise for someone who's just moved as well, because, I mean, all those thoughts are, I'm thinking I'm not going to make any friends, I'm thinking I'm going to hate my job, I'm thinking it's going to be miserable here, I'm thinking something terrible might happen to my family while I'm away from them.
Yep.
And you're right, if you break it down into rational thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And even if it has, you can normally take it from other steps from there and get it to a point where you're thinking of it in a more positive attitude. And if you do find that you have quite a negative mindset all the time, then you probably do want to be talking to people who are more positive and getting that kind of rub from them. So whether it's a counselor or just friends you have, which have a more positive mindset, and they mean quite open to being a more positive person, because really there is no benefit to being a negative person. It won't really assist you or aid you in any way, and you'll only look back on your life later on and think, God, how much time did I waste being so bitter and frustrated and angry and fearful of things? And that's why I think people do have midlife crisis, because they get to a point where they think, God, I don't really like myself, and now I'm looking and I'm passing this birthday, which I never really thought I was going to get to, and it's so old. I can't believe how old I am. Oh, my God, I don't like who I am, and I have to make a change. And it's like for so long they've stunted their emotional growth, and then they get catapulted into the reality of middle age, and then they simply can't deal with it. So then they have to go buy a Porsche or something.
And some of our listeners are at the stage where they're thinking, do you know, Ryan, I didn't realise it, but Ryan's just explained to me that I am suffering from anxiety and I need to go and get some help. And what do people do who are living remotely? Like we do, we have a lot of expats who are in Hong Kong and Singapore and London and, you know, cities where they could find someone easily. But what about those who are living in very remote locations? What would you suggest they could do to seek some help?
If they have a relatively high quality internet, then online counseling has come a long way. I would say about 30 to 40% of my clients online. And I would say it is probably 95% effective in comparison to seeing them in person. The only difference is I think that there's an element that can sometimes get lost with a little bit of latency issues, a little bit of you don't have quite the same feeling as when they're sitting in the room, but it's as close. It really is as close as it can be. And I've made huge breakthroughs for people online. CBT counseling is the most common one. And if you just want to kind of discuss your issue, that's a very good place to go. If you find you have quite deep phobias, addiction difficulties, or trauma in the past, I'd recommend you look up a BWRT counselor. Those are all around the world as well. You can go to bwrt.org, I think it is, and type in your location, and they have counselors around the world there. The other thing I do always, I try and instill in people is the idea of becoming their own therapist on some level. Like, you're never going to get to a real professional level on it, but I always recommend to people that they get as much knowledge as they can. And don't watch those garbage BuzzFeed articles and videos and stuff. Go and watch a full lecture. There's all the lectures from Stanford and Yale online. Do yourself the favor of going and watching full lectures in a row, because then you'll get some real in-depth knowledge that you'll be able to ruminate and you'll be able to really develop on yourself with, rather than just, you know, the five ways to deal with anxiety now kind of thing. And it's like a 30-second little short bit on each one. You want to do yourself the service of really trying to educate yourself as much as possible, I would say. There are also several books I'd probably recommend that I can send you the links for.
Wow. You're right. He really did say a lot of good stuff. It's almost like he'd studied it for years and years and practiced it professionally. I thought it was good. Well, first of all, I love don't watch BuzzFeed article videos. That's great. Don't watch that 3 minutes of how I can beat my anxiety. Watch a long lecture, which people often in this world of where our attention span is getting shorter and shorter, you might go to a session with a psychologist and go for an hour, but you wouldn't watch an hour's video on YouTube necessarily.
Yes.
But having heard someone say that, you think, well, actually, that's more beneficial. So I might be able to do that, or I might choose to do that. I'm very, very excited about his breathing techniques, and I can't wait for the link because I'm onto that. I think we'll have family sessions of breathing techniques.
Do you know, Nikki, I did it. I did it yesterday because I am not a great meditator. And yes, the link will be on twofatexpats.com, and it will also be in the running sheet of the podcast. So in this video, you literally take these really deep breaths. Sort of thing, but there's constant and do that for, I don't know whether it was a minute or so. He's walking you through it. It's actually an interview that someone's done with him, and he gets the interviewer to do it with him. And then he says, breathe, 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 breathe. And you start to feel quite lightheaded because you're just taking in all this oxygen. And then he can get you to hold your breath for 2 minutes, and it works. It actually works.
Hang on. So you were holding your breath for 2 minutes?
Yes. So you suck in all this oxygen. You feel yourself going lightheaded, and you take it all in, and then he says, okay, hold. And you hold. And I can't tell you, there is something, and it is like a very meditative state because you're concentrating so hard on, am I really holding my breath this long? Oh, my God, I'm holding my breath this long. This has been going how long? And he's talking you through it. But I think it's taken me this long to learn that meditation isn't some amazing state that you're in. It's really it really is just clearing your mind. And I think I was of this ridiculous, I guess, now when I think about it, opinion of, you know, that you go into this meditative state and you're all, you know, in this particular sort of zeitgeist and, you know, whatever. And it's not. It's about clearing your mind and being silent and conscious and, you know, I don't know. What would you call it, Nikki?
No, I don't know, but it's one of the reasons I started listening, I think it's called the 10% Happier podcast, because it's not that someone that says they're really into meditation, but they said you don't have to be a guru to do it. You know, there are just little bits and pieces and different ways to get into it. I loved actually what about Ryan, how he said it's much easier to train your body and change your diet than to change your mindset. Because turning off your internal monologue takes a lot longer. And that's what you can do with meditation. So he's saying you can't do that all at once. Don't try and like fix yourself or fix your anxiety immediately. You know, you've got to be realistic about this. Next time you interview him, I'd like to know if you can catch anxiety from other people you live with, because that's something I'm quite interested in.
Yeah,
because I live with three people that have anxiety that manifests itself in different ways. And I just wonder sometimes I get to this state where I get quite heightened levels of what I feel are anxiety, but I don't know if that's real or if that's just like attributed anxiety from other areas because I'm trying to help or deal with different things. You know, the whole living with people with anxiety or depression, also really helpful. So many things we can talk to Ryan about. I'm making a list. Type them down.
There really are. And, you know, I know, Nikki, the word mindfulness has become, you know, such a buzzword, hasn't it? You know, for the last sort of 5 years, people have talked about mindfulness, and it's just growing and growing and growing. You know, we only have to look at our lives and the outside world to know why it's growing so much, because everybody's got a phone in their hand everywhere they go. And I have really noticed this swing of all the people that I've listened to for years and enjoyed reading their writing or listening to them. You know, I was listening to Will Anderson in a podcast yesterday, who is an Australian comedian, but he's also on the radio. He has a great television show called The Gruen Transfer. But I heard someone say to him, because he holds his podcast in his house, someone said, you look like you've been robbed, because he has no TV now or anything like that. And he's really like dropped his phone and started to, I guess, push those things out of his life. And I keep hearing this more and more and more. You know, I'm reading a book at the moment called Stillness is the Key by Ryan Holiday. Same sort of thing. I think we're all suddenly getting very hyper aware of, bloody hell, this phone is ruling my life. Do you know, there is no time in my nothing. Nothing's ever stops. There isn't that, that's the end. Now I'm going to sit at home for the end of my day and not have all this stuff. It's just there constantly.
It's quite interesting because working, obviously I can't look at my phone all the time. and my phone goes away, like it just gets put down and I don't pick it up very much at all. And I'm actually conscious that it's quite a change for me that I'm used to having it or checking it more regularly it's different to being working in my home office because when I do stuff here, I don't know, sometimes it's not that I'm giving myself permission. It's just that it's part of my habit. I'm in the house. I look at the phone. Whereas when I'm in the office, I've, you know, got 5 hours to get all the things I need done. So I'm much more focused on doing that and not yes. sort of doing that. So I actually have noticed in the last sort of week and one day that I am doing it less. So I will be interested when I get to the end of the week to see my stats that my phone tells me how long I've yes. been there, what I've
Your
been doing.
Weekly report. yes.
So I am looking forward to the breathing exercises and the books that he's mentioned. But I also really like that when you asked him about online and how do people remotely get access to this stuff, that there was a bit of truth in advertising. So he said, look, it is effective. It's almost effective as an in-person session. So he wasn't trying to say, you know, a remote counselor can solve all your problems and it's 100% the same. It's giving you sort of a realistic understanding and viewpoint. And I think as expats, we really need to, or as people that need these services remotely, we really need to understand that. And it's also great to hear someone say that.
Yes.
Because it doesn't put me off having a remote counsellor. It just makes me understand that, you know, there is a little bit of difference between doing it in person and online.
Yeah. One of the things I'm busting to talk to Ryan about is this brain working recursive therapy,
Oh, me too.
Yeah. And that, for people who were like me and weren't aware of what it actually was up until a couple of days ago, it's this therapy that involves altering the subconscious mind. And basically what that means is if you have a bad memory or some sort of phobia that has happened because of something in your life, he can sit down with you and says that it can be as fast as up to an hour of running through that memory and turning it into a more positive thought so that, you know, and this can be for somebody who maybe is terrified of flying or has a phobia about, you know, anything from bugs to public transport to whatever. But it sort of tackles anxiety and PTSD and grief, sort of low self-esteem, anything. So I'm really, really looking forward to talking to him more about that because I think that's something that Ryan specializes in. Okay, we'll pop the details of his website in our running sheet and on our website as well. And one of the things, if you have a question for Ryan, please, like, jump on our website, click on the little microphone. So twofatexpats.com, you'll see a little microphone on the right-hand side. Give it a click and record your question and we'll make sure that we get it to him.
And remember that if you do have an iPhone that you're using to access our website, you will need the SpeakPipe app to do that. But if you're on a desktop or a laptop, you should just be able to click on the website www.twofatexpats.com and be able to do it directly from the website.
Yes.
Just for our iPhone challenge customers.
Yes.
Just throw the phone wars in there, Kirsty. What are your three favorite things? What are things you love this week?
I loved Ryan. So that was one of the things because it sent me down that little path of breathing exercises and talking about things I'd never done. But my favorite thing by far this week has been Years and Years. And Nikki, you've spoken about Years and Years because of course it came out in the UK and in America a good 5 to 6 months ago, but for some reason it didn't pop onto Australian television screens until just this last week or 2 weeks ago. It's on SBS, and SBS, like ABC, have an iView, you know, app that you can, I think it's called SBS On Demand, for anyone who hasn't seen it and wants to see it. If you're in America, I think it's on Hulu and Amazon. And if you're in the UK, it's on BBC. There's two episodes that are out in Australia now. It airs on Wednesday nights. And so we have to wait. We have to wait, Nikki, till next, this Wednesday, before we can watch it again. And I'm horrified in myself that I can't wait. What's happening to me?
You know what's happening to you? The streaming wars, Kirstie. That's what's happening to you. You're used to immediate gratification. That's part of the problem of, you know, a series gets downloaded all at once and then you can binge watch it, et cetera. This is old school. This is like week at a time stuff. But it did do the same thing on Hulu. It did drop a week at a time. But the second episode, tell me what, this is a spoiler alert for anyone that hasn't listened, but tell me what is happening by the end of the second episode.
By the end of the second episode, the banks have shut, or the banks are in crisis, let's say. Yes. Refugees may have returned to their homelands. So for those who didn't listen to Nikki's, we'll do a really quick update because we've already done it and we've talked about it, but it is a fantastic concept of, we have Emma Thompson, who is a very Trump-like figure, who we see her start as an entrepreneur and then make her way into politics. And this series runs over 15 years. So at the beginning of it, you see that she's kind of this background figure on the telly that's being a little bit controversial while this family operates their lives day to day. And then as time moves on, we see the effect of what's happening in the world, how she's growing politically, what's happening between China and America, and what could possibly happen. The thing I love about this show, Nikki, is when they've looked, because they've had to predict, you know, the future, or, you know, it's very dystopian, and all the things that you think, you look at these futuristic ideas and you're like, oh, I could totally see that happening. So they have a child in this series who speaks with a filter on her face the whole time. Like, so the filters that we have on Instagram and Snapchat and whatever, you now, instead of just having it on your phone, you can put this little, you know, headband on and operate with this filter in front of your face. And this little girl spends most of her childhood speaking through a filter to her parents. And that is just one tiny part of the whole concept of this show, but it is.
And it's amazing. But the other thing is that you think, oh, these things, there's no way these things would happen. Like, okay, you've guessed the dystopian future, but will it happen? And then you think, there's no way it'll happen. And then you think, well,
this could totally happen.
These other things actually have happened. And it could totally happen. But
we're all watching them happen now. Yeah.
I love, though, the family connection that runs through the whole series, obviously.
Yeah.
But how they're all connected by their basically Amazon Alexa devices or whatever it is, where they do their phone calls.
Yes. So there is this recurring theme of, instead of Siri, it's Signor. Hey, Signor, what's the weather here? Hey, Signor, what's da-da-da-da? And I think, Nikki, the perfect balance is, it's British and it's a great British drama. It's a brilliant, it's one of those, you know, high-end, fantastic British dramas. But this family stays looking and being like every family, you know, you can identify with them. And yes, they have these group calls all the time where they're all in their separate houses and they're all talking about life, but there's still that beautiful familyness, that is not a word, but I'm making it one, about them while the chaos goes. And you can see that they've lost sight of it. Now, There is a viral video of the grandmother, because the grandmother is the voice of reason in all of this. And I had seen this video before I saw her on the show, and so a lot of people may have seen it as well, where an older woman is sitting at the family table, at the head of the table, and she says, "You've made this happen. You've created this." And she talks about the women on the checkout counters at the supermarket and how when we got rid of them and we made them into machines, and you made this happen because you bought the £1 t-shirt because you thought, oh, £1 for a t-shirt, that'll be great. But you didn't think about the 5 cents that you were paying the child that was making it, you know. And she does this sort of monologue, and it's absolutely brilliant and breathtaking. But yeah, that's from years and years.
Yes. And as my children would say, okay, boomer.
Yes. Which is very much the phrase this week, isn't it? Anyone who's listening, in 6 months' time, it's the week where the New Zealand Polly said to the men who were talking over the top of her in Parliament, okay, boomer, which is, yes, very much the phrase of the young. But tell me, Nikki, why is okay, boomer, okay to say? Because that is effectively us saying, all right, grandma, shut up.
Well, I've read some articles about that this week, about why it's okay to say it or why it's not okay to say it, and how people are being upset that it's ageist. And then some other boomers writing to say, look, it's fine. Every generation has their thought process where they think they know more than everybody else, and this is just happening. And because it is a meme, I was quite strange. A couple of weeks ago, my daughter said to me, are you a baby boomer? I said, I most absolutely am not. I'm from Gen. She said, well, where are you? You're not a millennial. I said, no, I'm not. I am from Generation X. And I explained what Gen X was. And we talked about all the different generations, and they talked about being Gen Zers and everything. And then 2 days later, okay, boomer burst on the scene. So what I realized was she was an early adopter, and she was trying to use it, but I had disabused her of the idea. My son, but on the other hand, doesn't care. He just says it all day.
Yes, because you don't actually have to be a boomer to get the okay boomer. You just have to be older than 25. So it's a very generic term, because I think it first started on TikTok, where there were all the TikTok, gifs of okay boomer. It's from a song.
Yeah.
And my daughter's lawn bowls team is called okay boomer. She's got like a Wednesday night bowls team where they are all gloriously young and brown and healthy and fit, and they go down to the local bowling club and have, you know, $3 beers and do whatever. But their team is called Okay Boomer. Okay Boomer. Okay, Grandma.
Could I tell you, it might go back to the Dunning-Kruger scale.
Yes.
Where you think you know more than you know, but you actually don't. You see how we tie it all in together, Kirsty? It's a theme, topical theme.
Hey, Nikki, I saw that you have been watching Why Women Kill, and I haven't seen this yet. Is it as good as I think it is?
Well, you know, I started watching it because I have the CBS app, and so it gives you the extra shows that they just do for the online world. It was created for that. It's just 10 episodes in series one, and it's about series is set in the same house in multiple time zones. So it's multiple time zones. That's not like 24 hours. That's time years.
Yeah, decades.
So in 1963, Jennifer Goodwin. 1984 is Lucy Liu, and in 2019 is Kirby Hal Baptiste from Killing Eve and The Good Place and the latest season of Veronica Mars. And the same thing runs through it. There's a death that occurs after the husbands of three married women commit adultery. But you don't sort of know what the death is, who the death is. It's called Why Women Kill, but you don't know who does it and why. And the whole thing is teasing it out. The first couple of episodes, I was thinking, I don't know if I'm going to like it. But by the end, I was so in. And like you, I was waiting for it to drop. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd check, has it dropped yet? Okay, do I have to wait all day to watch it, or do I have a Do I have a time slot that I can do that in? And it's so tough to pick your favorite wife because they just all act differently. Like they just, the scenarios are so different.
There's a phrase that's used here a lot in the Middle East. It's so tough to choose your favorite wife.
Stop it. But in this series, the acting is so strong. For me, it's very, very close between Jennifer and Lucy. But Lucy Liu, she plays the wife in 1984. So she has the big hair, you know, the fashion, the really poor taste in decoration. And she has a relationship with her on-screen husband who I think it's my favorite relationship that of anyone that they have. Yeah. So I think she ends up being my favorite, but it's tough to choose it. But I recommend it. If you haven't seen it, Why Women Kill, it's 10 episodes. It's worth a look. Okay. It's enjoyable. Yeah, definitely.
Excellent. Okay. Now, how are you going with Modern Love and Dolly Parton's America?
Oh, I absolutely downed Modern Love. And I think I messaged you. I said, oh, I'm having a Modern Love marathon. And you said, just wait till you get to the last 10 minutes of the last episode. And I was thinking, what could it possibly be? But it was amazing.
It was so good.
But I have heard this week I was listening to The Hilo, which I've talked about on here before, with Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes. And they talked about how Modern Love has got such bad reviews because it's so schmaltzy. And it's not, you know, that people said, oh, you know, but it's based on the real stories that people wrote, right? So
exactly.
I think you can't criticize it for being schmaltzy because it's just, I was very interested to listen to them talk about it actually, Kirsty, because you have talked about how you've read Modern Love for years and years and you've listened to the podcast. And they talked about how some of the episodes that they didn't enjoy as much when they were reading them actually turned out better on screen.
Wow.
So they said that was a better one to put on screen, maybe than perhaps their favorite Modern Love essay wouldn't necessarily translate as well to the screen, which I thought was a really interesting point.
Do you know what I've found out this week, which I didn't know when we spoke about it? The one where they use Tina Fey, she's playing tennis, and it's a whole analogy about their relationship. Now, I remember when I first read that, and I remember thinking this is so beautifully told because I think it's easy to tell stories of romance and meeting each other and whatever. It's harder to write about people who have been together for 20 years and rediscovered their love, right? You know, it's to make you fall in with that love story. So in that story, I remember reading it for the first time. I remember hearing the podcast from the writer where she talked about her husband, Dennis, because remember they played Dennis tennis. He talks about, you know, we're going to play Dennis tennis. Her husband is Dennis O'Leary, as in the actor Dennis O'Leary, who I really, really like. So Dennis O'Leary starred and created Rescue Me. I don't know if you ever watched that, Nikki, but it was very much, he's always kind of this no bullshit, very sort of sex, drugs and rock and roll kind of actor. So it changed everything for me with thinking, oh, that was his wife. And I only realized because I was listening to something, I can't remember which podcast, I'm sorry everyone, because I know it's annoying when you talk about these things and you don't say exactly where to find them, but it was a podcast I was listening to where someone raised the fact that was actually about Dennis O'Leary, that when his wife wrote it, she copped quite a bit of flack because she had crossed that Hollywood line of writing about their personal life and, you know, making him human, you know, and sharing something, and that wasn't really done then because she wrote it quite some time ago.
Yeah, so when I watched it, I thought I had a momentary interest in, oh, he's an actor. I wonder which actor this is about, because that's certainly part of the conversation they have and the therapy that they have, et cetera, and how he doesn't have to do anything and how people react to him differently. But then I felt I didn't need to know because the story was so important and it was about their relationship and it was about her and it was about how it all worked and or didn't work and what happened. And so I thought, you know what, it doesn't really matter. And I think that by putting Tina Fey in that role when they're doing this, that was very clever, like to make the actress the focal point, to make her sort of the star of it. And so it makes you not wonder about who Dennis was, but Dennis O'Leary. Very interesting. I mean, it's great to know, but I didn't know.
And, Nikki, that's so true. I was the same. Like when they have the scene where they're in their at their dining table and he comes home from the play that he's been to, and she starts asking him about work, and he says, oh, you wouldn't have liked it and blah, blah, blah. And I do same thing. I remember thinking, oh, he's an actor. I wonder who he is. And then just automatically kind of, I guess, assumed, oh, no, he's probably more of a, you know, he's in plays and he's, you know, not a very well-known actor or whatever. But, yeah, I didn't immediately Google which actor is this about, which I would normally, you're right, but the story was so strong. It was it was really well done. Oh, I'm glad you liked it, and you've been enjoying Dolly as well.
Loving Dolly. And we did have our whole Facebook Live that we were going to do about Dolly Parton, Dolly Parton's America, because you listen to it and then I listen to it, and then I've also heard it discussed on every podcast I listen to almost, and as being something so relatable, and so many people are finding it relatable. And as we said, we also found it relatable just to listen to, but also because it really does have an expat focus or an expat alignment.
I think that is the interesting thing about listening to other people talk about Dolly. Like I have had my moment where I've gone, I really had a huge, Oprah would have called it an aha moment of I suddenly realized why expats can all relate to similar things, even though they're from different places. And it's like that thing I always laugh about, that in India, Kerala is called God's country, and that's how they advertise it, have come to God's country. Now in Australia, Queensland is commonly known as God's country and come to God's country. And then I suddenly realized after I lived in America and I lived in all these places that everybody has a God's country that they feel is a God's country. And I always think about my beautiful friend, Mikey McGovern, who was from Swift Current in Saskatchewan, and he called Swift Current God's country. And some people he met when he was traveling through Europe came to visit him in Swift Current. And the first thing they said was, who is your God? Because they did not feel it was God's country. But how Mikey McGovern feels about Swift Current and how I feel about Renmark are the same thing. Do you know, we have the same feeling. And I suddenly, it kind of came to me of all the people I've met in my travels of how they feel a certain way about a certain place and what that brings to them, and how you can relate to someone, even if your things are so very, very different, you can both relate to that feeling of how you're feeling about missing home or missing a smell or getting a sense of that smell from somewhere, you know, whether it's a meal that's cooked or it's, you know, something that's said, where you can relate with each other about a feeling that you're both having about a place. So, yeah, I loved it. But like you, I was listening to, I think, Chats 10 Looks 3, where I heard Lee Sales go on for about 10 minutes about Dolly. But for her, it was all about the music and the chords and the country and the, as in the country music. So I think Dolly's giving everybody something different, isn't it?
Which is so true, because that's what she says. She wants to give everybody something. And it's just for a friend of mine in the States who always contacts me sort of randomly on WhatsApp and says, what do you got for me podcast wise? You know, what should I listen to? I said, listen to Dolly Parton's America. She said, get out. I said, no. I said, you'll really like it. She said, I don't believe you. I said, come on, have I ever given you a dodgy podcast recommendation? She said, no, you haven't. And I said, okay, listen. Anyway, I haven't heard back, so maybe our friendship's over. But I really have found that everybody really usually enjoys it.
It's the research, isn't it, Nikki? It's because it is so well researched and it goes.
Oh, it's the production. Yeah, it's the production.
It just goes down little pathways that you don't think it's going to go on. And I mean, you and I both love podcast production and storytelling. And so I am sure that you had that little prickle on your skin like I did when he goes for his walk down to the lake at Dolly's house and he sees the snake and he does whatever and he has his moment of I'm suddenly understanding why Dolly means what she means to me, and talking about his dad and that he never understood what his dad and Dolly would have talked about. But when he then in his mind goes to Lebanon and they have the sounds of Lebanon and the sounds of him walking up the street. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is so well done. This is so well done.
Yeah, but that's a lot of time in production, editing, reviewing. That's a lot of people bringing that together. But what it is it makes you feel like there's not, that it's just him. Yes. And he just sat there and thought of this and all of a sudden it all came together. I mean, it's just so clever. Now, Kirsty, I spy with my expat eye. I've got something for you.
What did you spy with your little expat eye this week?
We are going to Australia at Christmas, which we're very excited about. And I messaged a friend who I was thinking, oh, she's moved back. I wasn't really sure. And I said, you know, and I was thinking that she might be around the area that we're going to be in. And so I messaged her. She said, it's like you're psychic. I'm at Hong Kong airport. I'm leaving Hong Kong for the last time, the final time. I can't talk to anyone because my nose is full of snot. I'm crying so much. Now, can you please give me all the good tips about being a repat? And I said, I'm not sure I can, but I'm feeling you because leaving Hong Kong is very hard. And I know that. And she's been there for 10 years, I think. But she said she is moving back to a macadamia farm near Byron Bay, and I have been in contact with her this week, and they're just about 15 Ks from the fire, so she's keeping an eye on it. But she said, call me when you're there, because it's about an hour from where we're going to be staying. And I said, I totally will. She said, and I know you will because you're my expat mate. They do what they say they will. When they say they call, they will. And I just thought, that's actually true. It is an expat thing, you know, because often you'll say, oh, I'll call you. And it doesn't really work out. But I tend to think that expats do make that extra bit of effort, particularly when they're home or if they haven't seen someone. Like you might think, oh, I haven't seen someone for 10 years or 8 years or 5 years. Oh, does it really matter? You know, do we need to catch up? But I kind of think that with expats, you always feel that you can pick up your friendship or your relationship from where you left off. It doesn't matter how long ago it was. I don't know. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. Well, you and I are going to catch up when you come to Australia.
That's right.
But, yeah, I do think. I think if I had an old expat friend that was coming anywhere near me, within an hour and a half near me in Australia, I would make sure that I caught them, because that would also be so exciting to be able to see them. Is it that? Is it because your friends back home are kind of easily accessible in that you're home all the time, or, you know, you feel like, oh, well, if I don't see them this year, I'll see them next year. You know, I will catch them at some point. But is it that your expat friends, when you do those expat goodbyes, you leave thinking, holy moly, I have no idea if I'm ever going to see you again? Like, especially if it's someone who's not from your home country. You know, like, I say goodbye to South African friends and English friends and whatever, and I seriously do say goodbye now thinking, and this too comes with age, I think, because when you're young, everything is infinitely possible. Do you know? You know, hey, maybe we'll live in New York. Maybe we'll live in London. Maybe we'll do whatever. And then sort of 20 years down the track, you're going, oh, God, now I've got kids that are here and there and I've got this and that happening. And so maybe that's not a possibility like it was. So, yes, I think you're right, because you realise you've got to make the most of it while you've got it.
Yeah, and that was just my very definitive expat moment this week, where she said, yeah, you totally will. And I don't know. I always think that when you say goodbye, you have to believe in the possibility you're going to see someone again, because otherwise the goodbye is too hard. Otherwise.
Well, I don't even say goodbye. I just say, I'll see you next time.
Oh.
I never say goodbye to anyone. I always just say, okay, I'll see you next time, because I hate goodbyes. So there has to be a possibility that you're going to see someone again.
Perfect.
I think we're done. Are we done?
We're done. We're done. It's not even 7:30 a.m.
I like this. I think we should do them over morning coffees far more often. All right, Nikki, good luck for the rest of your working week, and I will talk to you again next week.
Speak to you then. Bye.
Bye.